propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. On today's program, we'll look at the power of the people's airwaves. We'll have a segment on radical radio and the importance of radio around the world, as well as podcasting with Rachel Jolly of the Index on Censorship. We'll also hear from Michael Levitin and look at an organization called the Incorruptibles, looking for progressive political reform in the grassroots level around the country, at the city council level and on. And we'll finish the show with L. Aviv Newton of Poets Reading the News. Please stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we have a great lineup, and we have some central themes. We're going to begin talking about the power of radio, radical radio, and power to the people's airwaves. Later in the show, we'll have poets reading the news and also a clip on the Incorruptibles about progressive grassroots reform and change. Our first segment today, we are joined by the one and only Rachel Jolly, the editor of Index on Censorship magazine that comes out of London. Rachel is the editor, again, of Index on Censorship, and she was awarded Specialist Editor of the Year in the British Society of Magazine Editors in 2016. And, of course, Project Censored has partnered over the years with Index on Censorship, and Rachel Jolly has a piece in our new book, Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World. Rachel Jolly, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to talking to you.
Well, I am excited to have you on. Index on Censorship is one of our favorite organizations. We've certainly done things with you all before. Listeners who don't know, please go to indexoncensorship.org and subscribe digitally if you can and support this very important organization. We think it's really just fabulous. Indexoncensorship.org. Well, Rachel Jolly, there's a reason we're talking to you now, and it's because the latest issue of your magazine, Free to Air, talks about why the rebirth of radio is delivering more news. And here we are on community radio, and the Project Censored Show airs on close to 40 stations around the U.S. and, of course, is online and is a podcast and so on. And we firmly believe that radio is a very, very powerful medium. And that's why I mentioned, you know, power to the people's airwaves. So, Rachel Jolly, tell us about this issue.
Well, you know what? I started off thinking about podcasts and thinking about how more and more people were listening to podcasts and why that was happening. And then I got into traditional radio and why that's still being used in different parts of the world. And then we found that podcasts are being used in new and exciting ways to get around authoritarian regimes and bust censorship and more stuff kept coming out. And the issue just got more and more fascinating. We basically looked across the world at the most interesting creative ways that radio was being used, as well as some stories about how governments felt threatened by radio and what they were doing to try and close stations down.
That's very fascinating in terms of the angle here that you have. And tell us a little bit about what you have found in terms of, let's start technologically from the present. Maybe we'll end up going in reverse historical order. But tell us about how podcasts have maybe affected radio and why podcasts not only are important in and of themselves, but they are different than radio, though there is obviously great overlap in here. So what can you tell us about what you found out?
Well, I think most people know about podcasts as a form of radio programs. You can now download them and listen to them as you travel around or do your washing or do your cycling across town. And we're interested to discover a bit more about that and the numbers rising and why different organizations were getting involved in podcasting and making it much more easy to access. The angle that we weren't so aware of when we set off on the commissioning trail was how in authoritarian countries, podcasting is being used as a way to circumvent censorship regulations. So, for instance, in Vietnam, there's a podcast called Loa, LOA.FM, and it covers challenging stories. It's hosted outside Vietnam, and it hasn't sought permission from the authorities. And then, of course, you know, the regulations haven't really caught up with the technology yet, so there's no need for them to do so. But they're able to carry quite challenging stories in a country where if those stories were broadcast or published in a different way, they probably wouldn't get published. So there were places like Vietnam. There's a great podcast in Zimbabwe called Politics and Beyond, which we looked at again, a case of, you know, being able to cover stories and put them out there just using very easy-to-access technology. You know yourself that to make a podcast, you actually can just use your phone, maybe a little editor that you can also have on your phone. You don't need much more than that, and then upload it to something like SoundCloud or different platforms. So we just found these really fascinating stories of how people in countries which have problems accessing independent news were using podcasts to get great stories out there.
So, Rachel Jolly, we've seen the technological changes then that are making it more possible and more available for people to do podcasts. And again, this is like a real platform in terms of citizen journalism, right? We don't necessarily have to have the big radio station. You don't have to have the very large and expensive kinds of equipment, and you don't need whole teams of people. But what you're saying is, I don't know, would you say it's revolutionary on a certain scale?
It's just giving people power, isn't it? So we've called one of our sections Power to the Podcast, and I think there's really something in that. They're just really creating a tool to share knowledge and information in some of the world's most highly censored areas. I mean, and they're growing in popularity and influence. It's just a real surprise, I think, that podcasting is having that form where it's just getting around rules and regulations, and it doesn't encounter problems in the same way that a newspaper would.
Well, right. And again, it doesn't have the propaganda model problems per se, right? It doesn't have a pressure of owners in a for-profit system and
exactly.
Advertiser dollars and all of that business. And of course, it really opens up a voice and a platform for local communities, particularly in places where you just described, where there is more overt types of censorship.
That's right. I think the cheapness of it, the ease to get hold of these tools is a really major factor here. Just that you can do this in your home. I mean, imagine how difficult this would have been to do 20 years ago and the size of the equipment that you would needed and the technological know-how would have been so much greater. And then obviously as people use podcasting platforms and podcasting editing tools more regularly, they get more sophisticated and they can do more and more with that content. But it is helping people in lots of small communities break through these barriers and get stories out, get information out. That's really, really important.
And we're speaking with Rachel Jolly, editor at the Index on Censorship. You can learn more at indexoncensorship.org. Their Autumn 27 issue is titled Free to Air, Why the Rebirth of Radio is Delivering More News. So, Rachel Jolly, are we seeing then, because of this technology, the younger generation, millennial generation, have often been referred to in some sectors as digital natives? They have sort of a propensity toward this kind of technology. Are we seeing more people, or more young people, maybe crossing over from podcasting and actually listening to radio? What do you have to say about that topic?
Yeah, surprisingly, radio is on the rise with all sorts of age groups, particularly in Britain and America. We looked at mainstream radio, and the audience numbers have grown considerably in the last 12 months. So we're seeing across the board more people listening to news and talk radio, and they're outstripping music radio. So I thought that was a really, you know, I was really pleased to hear that people were researching information and actually wanting to hear more news. You can put that down to troubled times in the world and people wanting to just find out more about what's going on in their local politics, perhaps. But part of it is access to technology, but I think some of it's digital and some of it's old school. You know, it's the two things combined. And you know, in different places, one is necessary. I mean, maybe in places where there's no access to the internet, you've got a great local radio station that's not doing everything through the internet. But in other places, the internet is there access to a whole new audience.
Well, micro radio, low power FM, there's fairly burgeoning scene in the United States on that front.
Yeah, apparently Americans listened to 11.5 billion hours of news in 2016, according to Nielsen. So that's a huge amount of information that people are listening to and tuning into.
And Rachel Jolly, would you opine that perhaps it's also due to the abject failures of corporate media, particularly television and cable, that has people fishing around or hungry for different perspectives and more in-depth kind of reporting?
Well, I wonder how much this might be stimulated by this whole conversation around fake news, because perhaps, and you know, this is just an opinion, I'm not looking at research here, but it has that conversation that made people think, well, what are my sources? You know, maybe question the information that they're getting and look for things that are better researched, that are more long form, that are more detailed, that they think more journalism's been put into it, you know, rather than perhaps just trust something that's coming to them over Twitter, over Facebook, that doesn't have much substance to it. And, you know, I wonder if it's just made people a bit more skeptical and made them dig a little deeper.
Well, I would say that anything that is going to propel people or motivate people to dig deeper. Digging Deeper was the title of a chapter in one of our books a few years ago with Elliot Cohen that actually talked literally about critical media literacy education, the medium that information comes through that strongly encouraged people to think critically. And I would say that in my experience, I do hear more critical, in-depth kind of conversations taking place on radio, far above television, for example.
Yeah, and I think something about radio gives people space to think about what's being talked about and discussed. But, all you know, radio presenters, radio shows have a bit more space to go into depth, don't they? And, you know, you get shows that go on and podcasts that a whole hour on one single subject. They really dig into it. And there's obviously an audience for that.
Again, I'm biased here at the Project Censored Show. Peter Phillips and I have been doing the show for nearly 7 years. And there's just something really special about the medium, about radio, and about having conversations with people where imagery is not clouding the way people are taking in information. And I really agree with what you said about the digging deeper element. And we certainly do a lot in education with establishing information integrity, critical thinking skills. We teach college. We focus on these types of things. And we assign more and more, we assign things for students, not just to read, but podcasts or particular radio shows. And it's been pretty remarkable just in our experience to see the kind of feedback and the reception that we get from students, and particularly young traditional students that are really kind of turning on to radio. In fact, I know a lot of the younger students I have that do podcasting or listen to podcasting, I mentioned to them that we have a show, a radio show, and they say, well, what do you mean? You have a podcast? And I'm like, well, yes, it's archived. And so, yes, I guess it's kind of a podcast too. And then they say, oh, well, where is it? When can we hear it? You know, and the one different thing about the radio now, of course, analog, traditional radio, since we do archive and put it online, people can listen to it at their leisure or when they have time, like podcasting.
Exactly, and people have got getting used to that, aren't they? So the idea that, oh, that show went out, but I missed it, so I'm never going to have the chance to listen to it ever again, that's gone for most of us. You know, oh, here's a show, I wanted to listen to it, I'm going to download it now, I'm going to listen to it in 2 weeks' time, I'm going to keep it for my cycle ride to work, and I'm going to listen to it then. All those things become options, and so there's a chance for it to open up new audiences, and you're getting sort of cult podcasts that people just want to listen to everything. And they're not doing sort of Beyonce's latest dress and sort of that kind of, well, I mean, they may well be doing that. I haven't seen any, but there might be. But they're also doing like really in-depth investigative stuff. I mean, something like Serial was really investigative journalism, wasn't it? And a lot of people say Serial was the tipping point for podcasting, and it really suddenly the audiences grew to exceptional levels.
Well, so let's talk a little bit more about that, Rachel Jolly. Investigative journalism on the radio. We've been riffing around a little bit on how in-depth this is and how radio seems to give more space to listeners and also provides more breadth for people to have these conversations. Can you maybe give us an example or two or some things that Index has been working on or is in the latest issue that pertain to investigative journalism on radio?
We did look at the trends, as I was saying, from Serial onwards, that has given people the opportunity to do investigative pieces using the traditional investigative journalism skills, but then recording them onto podcasts and then getting this big audience. We talked to a radio presenter who is a regular on BBC Radio 4 called Robin Ince, who presents, is a co-presenter of a science radio show, and he said one of the big things, he presents a thing called The Infinite Monkey Cage, and he just love the long discussions pieces and that you can get into a lot of depth in these sort of hour-long shows that just really dig into science subjects. So we also looked at the way that in Ukraine and Syria, we found an amazing radio station that's been set up through crowdfunding in the Ukraine, where a lot of the journalists involved had dropped out of the other radio stations that they worked for, because they were being leaned on by corporations and their bosses to twist stories in a particular manner, and they didn't want to do that anymore. So they basically went away and set up their own radio station. They crowdfunded it. And they make these in-depth programs. They travel around different towns and talk to people about local issues. And, you know, it's the fact that they've crowdfunded means they've got that independence to cover subjects and not be give them a spin in that prefers, you know, some big corporation would like them to cover in a certain way.
Well, so it seems that the rise of podcasts and sort of a rejuvenation or rebirth of interest in radio, terrestrial radio, is going hand in hand with enhanced media freedom. It sounds like what you're saying.
Yeah, I think it's definitely giving people more tools to move away from typical types of funding. So, you know, in various cases, crowdfunding has given them the opportunity. Now, we don't know. Nobody knows if crowdfunding is going to be something that goes on forever. Right now, it's something exciting, and people are finding it helps them create something like a new radio station. But in 3-4 years from now, are they going to be able to keep going? We don't know. But right now, it seems to be giving people the funds to start different types of radio stations that wouldn't have been able to survive without that as an option.
I'd like to remind listeners that this is the Project Censored Show. I'm the host, Mickey Huff, and I am in conversation with Rachel Jolly. Rachel Jolly is the editor of Index on Censorship magazine. It comes out of London. And you can learn more at indexoncensorship.org. After this musical break, we'll continue our conversation with Rachel Jolly. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. In this segment, we're speaking with the editor of Index on Censorship, Rachel Jolly, and we've been talking about their latest issue called Free to Air, Why the Rebirth of Radio is Delivering More News. So let's continue our conversation, Rachel Jolly, and let's tackle this issue. You mentioned earlier in our conversation that governments were afraid of radio. Can you expand on that idea?
I should point out that the magazine is a global magazine, so we try and cover every continent, and we have reporters around the world. So although there's a very small team in London, we have contributing editors in different parts of the world, and most of our reporters are nowhere near the UK, although we cover the UK as well. We felt it was really important to have a piece from Rwanda for this issue because of the way that radio was used negatively during the genocide in Rwanda. So we had a veteran reporter in Rwanda called Graham Holliday, who's covered Rwanda for many years, for Reuters and BBC and many other places, look at what the current situation for radio is today. And while there is more diverse radio and media than there was back in the 90s, some of the journalists said there's a veneer of freedom in Rwanda right now. There's a lot of self-censorship. The Rwandan government recently banned the BBC World Service, for instance. The access to different forms of news is not completely free, and there have been fewer abuses against journalists in recent years. As Reporters Without Borders have said, many of those who are critical of the regime have left. They've fled abroad and they're self-censoring. You know, they're not saying what they think.
Historically, governments have naturally been fearful of media. In places like the United States, it's often sort of behind the scenes or covert control, like CIA control of media through, you know, the mighty Wurlitzer and Mockingbird programs that we've written about at the project. But also some of the countries here that you're mentioning and you're talking about, government has more of an overt kind of fascination or interest in suppressing voices via radio. Yes?
That's right. In India, for instance, although the media has, India has a very vibrant media in some ways, it has huge numbers of newspapers, the state really controls radio news. So basically there's only one state news radio. That's it. There's no licenses for anybody else to start a news radio station. And it's really surprising, given the way that the news media, the newspaper media has moved on and has massive readership, that the government hasn't opened up on radio. So what we looked at a project that's done something quite clever to get around that, and it's basically using old mobile phones, not smartphones, the old ones, the old sort of Nokia-style ones. And people basically in lots of remote parts of India share those phones as a means of accessing and conversing with different people. But in this case, they can phone up and listen to basically recorded news, but they can also phone in their own stories, and then those stories are fact-checked and then put on this recording. So it's kind of using old technology in a way to circumvent the rules that the government has put in place. And although the Indian government has been saying for years it's going to liberalize news radio, it just hasn't yet.
So this is how radio is being used to get around censorship.
It's a very unconventional form of radio, but it's using the tools that people have, and it's not high tech. It's kind of a mix of old tech and doing something quite clever with it.
Well, again, this is not only fascinating news, but certainly welcome news that these developments are taking place. And of course, Index on Censorship is really exploring this. And again, to have your latest issue of Index on Censorship magazine dedicated to this issue about why the rebirth of radio is delivering more news, it's welcome news. And we're very delighted to have you on the program and to hear more about Index on Censorship. So, Rachel Jolly, if you could, would you like to revisit the topic here of mapping media freedom and talk a little bit about Index on Censorship in that way? Because I'm glad that you pointed out, like Project Censored, we're a very small staff, but we do tend to cover national and, in fact, international issues involving censorship. And since 1972, 4 years older than us, Index on Censorship has really been doing this. Can you tell us more about some of the projects that Index on Censorship is involved in, including mapping media freedom?
As you say, we've been around publishing the magazine since 1972. But more recently, we've been using digital technology to do different types of mapping and of censorship. So the Mapping Media Freedom Project is run by some of my colleagues, and it covers attacks on the media in 42 countries around Europe. And on a daily basis, we have a set of correspondents around Europe, and they will send in reports, and actually anyone can send in a report. It's really open to the public to send in any report they feel is important, and those reports are then fact-checked by the editors. They look for three strong sources, so you know we can tell that the story stands up. Once it does, it's published, and then it's mapped, so it's graphically mapped, so you can see how many attacks we've reported in a particular country, so the Czech Republic or Poland or Hungary or Russia, for instance, in over a set period. So there's a tool by which you can say, I'm really interested in Spain, where there's been several attacks on the media recently, and we're concerned about the increasingly repressive atmosphere there. So I'd like to look at how many attacks you've reported on the media in Spain in the last 6 months, and you can drill down and it will bring up a graphic that shows you how many there's been. So it's a way of logging attacks in different ways, so, you know, that have been happening, so all sorts of things from physical violence to people being killed to being threatened and so on. So that's a project that is open to the public to look at any time. Just Google Mapping Media Freedom and it will pop up. And it's something that is a really good resource if anyone is researching media freedom to have it give that. We're not saying that it's definitive. We can't actually show that we're grabbing every single attack, but these are the ones reported to us, and what the advantage of the tool that we're using is, it's quite timely. So some other organizations do annual reports, but this is much quicker than that. We're putting things up every day.
This is an incredible resource. I urge listeners to go to indexoncensorship.org. And it was, I believe, earlier in the spring, you had an edition of Index that addressed censorship and press freedom in the United States. It's not just Trump, U.S. media freedom fraying at the edges.
That's right. We put out a special report looking at media freedom in the U.S. So we, again, collected stories and fact-checked stories to look at attacks on journalists in the U.S. And one of the things that Index has always done is cover the whole world. So we don't want to be accused if, you know, you're not focusing on your own. So we look at the U.S., we look at the U.K., we look at Europe, we look at South America. We've always made sure where things are happening. That's not to say every magazine covers everything, or, you know, we also cover things on our website because it's impossible to cover everything. But we don't just drill down and focus on one area of the world. And right now, as you know, there's a lot of attacks on the freedom of expression happening around the world. So what we've seen in Turkey in the last year has been pretty horrifying.
I was just going to mention Turkey. You wrote about it in the book. Can you talk a little about that?
Yes. We have been running an online project called Turkey Uncensored, where Turkish journalists and artists were able to write the stories that they weren't allowed to write in Turkey. So it was basically creating a platform working with people who either were still in the country or had recently left to give them the platform to write those stories, and so they could reach the wider public. They're written in English. English is a language that many people either have as their second or third language, if it's not their first. Part of the reason for that was just the horror that we have at how media freedom has spiraled downwards in Turkey this year. We're seeing, you know, journalists locked up and threatened and fined and constant trials. You know, it's a situation that I don't think a few years ago people would have imagined would have happened so quickly, the way that democracy is being unpicked there so quickly.
I'm afraid that that's an accurate assessment, Rachel Jolly, Index on Censorship. We see a lot of this, and including in our recent book, one of the stories, the story number 11 on law enforcement surveillance of phone records, involves the J20 case from the inauguration of Trump. Certainly, we've seen a fairly significant pattern of violence and arrests against journalists in St. Louis. And again, this report you have on your website, indexoncensorship.org, for our listeners in the U.S., the title is It's Not Just Trump, U.S. Media Freedom Fraying at the Edges. I urge listeners to not only read this detailed account, very well done, by the way, Rachel Jolly, but also encourage people to look at the broad work that Index on Censorship is doing, that you just heard Rachel Jolly describing, that they really do try to look at a global perspective and global issues surrounding media freedom around all continents. And you should definitely be lauded for, again, the breadth, the depth, and the scope of the fine work of Index on Censorship. Rachel Jolly, we are running out of time in this segment, but I would like to just give you room for last words and to share with our listeners anything that you'd like them to know about Index on Censorship and Media Freedom.
I actually wanted to mention Mexico. We've just really been trying to raise the profile of what's happening to journalists in Mexico over the last decade. We just created a special investigation into what's been happening in the last 7 years, and I'm not sure enough people know about how dangerous it's become for journalists in Mexico, particularly those working in local journalism. It's looking like this is going to be the year of the highest number of journalists murdered for at least the last 20 years. Absolutely frightening level of violence there. So that's something that I really, really want more people to know about. A country not so far from you guys over in California, and somehow I feel like less people are aware of it than they should be.
Rachel Jolly, the editor of Index on Censorship. Again, Index on Censorship is an award-winning global quarterly magazine with reporters and contributing editors around the world. Founded in 1972, was primarily interested in publishing untold stories of dissidents behind the Iron Curtain, have published so many well-known authors over the years and some of the greatest campaigning writers of our age. Again, Rachel Jolly, thank you so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show and so much of the important work you do at Index. on censorship, and especially like to thank you for your wonderful recent issue, specifically looking at the power of radio and, again, power to the people on the people's airways. Rachel Jolly, thanks for joining us on the Project Censored Show.
It's great to talk to you.
Up next on the Project Censored Show, we'll hear from our senior correspondent, Michael Levitin, who is in conversation with Anna Callahan, and they'll be talking about a group called the Incorruptibles, and they'll be dealing with incorruptible politicians not being born, they're made. They'll talk about their campaign after this musical break. Stay with us.
I'm Michael Levitin with Project Censored, and we're speaking today with Anna Callahan. Anna helped organize the Bernie Sanders campaign in the East Bay in Berkeley back in 2016, and she is now the co-founder of the Incorruptibles. It is a Berkeley-based group, but it has national ambitions. They want to create thousands of Bernie Sanders to run in local office here and across the land. So welcome, Anna.
Well, thank you.
So tell us, that's a pretty catchy, when I read it and heard it the first time, let's create 1,000 Bernie Sanders, 1,000 Bernies. It sounded pretty good. What do you mean by that as a group, and what does that entail?
A number of us who had been on the Bernie campaign were talking in the fall about what was really wrong with government. And we came up with a single simple concept, which is that it's not filled with Bernie Sanders. If every senator and every representative and on down the line to state and local elections, if every politician were someone who was genuinely representative of the people, of the 99% of the vulnerable, then we would not have any of the problems that we have today. We would not have the climate change problems, minimum wage problems, healthcare problems. Like, all of those problems would go away instantly.
Okay, so that's a pretty idealistic world and rather utopian.
Yes.
But even if we just started with, say, 5% of people who were like that, or who would say, I'm not taking any corporate campaign donations, only small donations, you're talking about starting from a really grassroots base, right? He's one man. He's fired up the nation. Now he's really the standard bearer of the progressives in the country, not even as a Democrat, but as an independent. So what does it mean to take his message and all of a sudden try to bring that out in other potential candidates who might run for office?
We actually looked into this a lot, and we realized that the only way that people like Bernie can get started is at the local level. They just don't have the money, the influence. Like, they would have to take millions of dollars in corporate money in order to start at national politics. So that means that our strategy is to begin by organizing at the local level and getting really great people elected in their city councils and mayors. So that's where we're starting. We can then move up, of course, to state and then national. But at the moment, we're missing what's called a deep bench. I think it's a sports term, but also a political term. And it means that we don't have enough great people at the local level to move up to state level.
Right. And so clearly, this is a conversation being had across the country. There's many groups since Trump's election in November, I think practically instantaneously. Lots of people thought it's time to organize, the Republicans, and this far-right sort of view in the country has just shockingly wiped out a lot of what we thought were progressive gains and moving forward with, you know, with the half steps, the baby steps that the Obama years gave us, but that we were moving in that direction. So with a lot of groups, say, coming to try to do this now, everyone sees the urgency. What is different, and what does the Incorruptibles want to bring to the table?
We're doing something that no other group is doing. And some of that is that we're following this model created by the Richmond Progressive Alliance with some additional tools from, you know, Bernie and the way that he interacts with his voters, his constituents, as well as some great union organizers. So we're taking the best practices from a number of different groups, and we are applying these to our training for grassroots organizers. One big way that the Richmond Progressive Alliance style, this is a group from Richmond, California.
Which was instrumental in trying to stop the foreclosure crisis and in beating, they've been fighting Chevron for years.
That's right. They've really done an amazing, they're incredibly successful in only about 10 years. They have become the dominant political force in the city of Richmond, which was previously kind of owned by Chevron. They, you know, paid into every political campaign. So the Richmond Progressive Alliance model, which we're calling it their model, even though it's a mixture of things, their model really means that instead of candidates choosing themselves, that the community chooses the candidates. And that's very important, because if you wait until people decide to become candidates, that's a self-selecting group of mostly men, mostly white, mostly wealthy. And you're missing out on the best people that could become fantastic local politicians and then move up to state and national.
So these are people who have been active in their communities for years, who've led or taken part in organizations, and who aren't known, obviously, by the establishment class, but who already really have a base of people that would elevate them, would nominate them, sort of, or ask them to become candidates. Is that?
Yes. In a lot of ways, they are people who are deeply embedded in their communities, people who have done service work for a long time. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they come with their own voter base. That, I think, is also a mistaken impression, that all we have to do is choose these people, like get them to run, and they'll come with their own voters. This model really builds our base of voters. So in a typical campaign training, you're taught to reach out to the people who are most likely to vote, because those are the people that are going to show up at the polls. And you don't want to waste your time, quote unquote, with people who haven't voted in the past. But our model is actually to reach out to those people who are disenfranchised first, because those are people for whom no one is speaking and no one is representing. So if you give them genuine agency, if you give them a real opportunity not only to give their political opinion, but to be involved in creating a platform to perhaps run as a candidate themselves, or to choose who's going to be a candidate, then many of them will become involved in politics. But it has to be real. You can't just say, oh, we listen.
Process.
And none of them ever see any change happening based upon their opinions. It has to be a genuine agency that they have in their city. But when you do that, you increase the number of voters. And that leads to entirely different elections.
So right now, so it sounds like you've started by having some talks, giving some, organizing people in Fremont. Is that correct?
And that's right.
Other parts of the East Bay.
Yep. We've had a number of different groups in the Bay Area, actually, South Bay and East Bay and San Francisco, that are taking our workshops or have already signed up to take our workshops. We also have a number of groups in the Boston area, just because I happened to live there, and I visited recently and talked to a number of groups there that are very interested. We've had groups in Nebraska that are interested. So at this point, it's just a question of us setting up the workshops. We are developing an online training, but that's probably going to take a couple of months before that's up.
And what is the website and place people can go?
It is theincorruptibles.us.
.us.
And sometimes people spell incorruptibles with an A. It doesn't have an A. It's incorruptibles.
So it's fascinating and it's so timely. And everybody on this side of the aisle, the crisis that we're in as a country, everyone sees that we need to win office. I think that years ago, say with the Occupy movement and with activists, it was kind of a rejection outright of the corrupt political process. People were fed up, Democrats, Republicans, no one was doing anything. The housing crisis, they weren't jailing or prosecuting bankers. It was clear the system was broken. And the left, the what we call left in our country, the really far progressive set seemed to kind of give up in a sense or say we're doing this in the street, we're doing this through protest, we don't want to make Occupy a political movement. Of course, the Tea Party, which had come out roaring out in the streets and waving flags and being vocal, they ended up forming a party and becoming essentially the takeover of the Republican Party and shifted the entire discourse in the country. So now, years after Tea Party and Occupy, now it's as though with Trump, people are ready to actually go and become candidates and say, we're not going to change this unless we are holding office, right? What's the energy that you're seeing from people, say, at these talks you're giving? And how are you giving it? What do you say to inspire local people who never considered having office, holding office, to say you can be it, or you can nominate, or you can help?
I think you're asking two questions.
And probably.
The first question is, what is this new world political reality that we live in? And it is truly inspiring to realize how many people became politically active within the last couple of years. We're going to grassroots groups that have requested that we come in and introduce ourselves and talk about what we do. And for those people, they've been, maybe the group has existed for 6 months or for a year, whether it's Indivisible or a revolution group or Democracy for America, any of these groups, they're at the point where they're like, oh, this is hard. This is hard, and we're already getting stuck in a rut, and we don't know how to do X, Y, and Z. So it's great for us because we see the gap between where people are and where they want to be, and we can kind of, by being outside and not deep in the nitty-gritty, we can help them bridge that gap. So the second question you raised is, how do we reach people who are not politically active? And we definitely have some ideas on that we've taken from fantastic union organizers and politicians. That would be a longer discussion, so maybe we can get into that next time.
And why don't you tell listeners there's an event coming up on November 1st, I believe?
We're having a national call on November 1st, which is Wednesday at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. You can go to our website, which is theincorruptibles.us. to get more information on that and to register for that call.
So we were speaking with Anna Callahan, the co-founder of The Incorruptibles. Thank
Absolutely.
You, Anna.
Absolutely. Thank you.
We're going to take a break here, Project Censored, and we'll be right back.
This is the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. That was a segment by Michael Levitin talking about The Incorruptibles. You can learn more about that at theincorruptibles.us. In the final segment today, I am going to turn our attention to an organization, to a group, to a publication, to a happening. It's called Poets Reading the News. Their website is poetsreadingthenews.com. And I'm joined today in the studio by editor-in-chief of poetsreadingthenews.com. That would be Elle Aviv Newton. Elle, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Hello, Mickey. Nice to be here. Thank you.
So tell us, what is Poets Reading the News?
Poets Reading the News is a digital platform for journalism in verse. We bridge poetry and journalism. So we publish primarily poetry, but sometimes prose, all about contemporary events.
Well, how did this come about? How long has Poets Been Reading the News been around, and where did the idea come from?
Yeah, we actually just celebrated our first year anniversary. We've been publishing since September, October last year. We started because we noticed that poetry was going viral on the internet, and we wanted to reinvigorate a poetry platform, basically, to make it geared toward the things that we were experiencing, reading, seeing, the protests we were involved in, the protests that were occurring around the world, stories that were getting neglected. And also, you know, we were very focused on making poetry something that we consider as part of the daily lexicon, the way we express in response to the news. So we launched a digital platform. And, you know, at first we contacted hundreds of poets around the world. We researched probably every poetry professor in America and emailed them. And, you know, it's amazing since it started, like, people have recognized the name, recognized the idea. It's resonated very quickly. Today we get submissions every day.
This is fantastic. So just in the past year, sounds like you've grown quite a bit, but in terms of interest, in terms of the website, in terms of content and outreach.
Yeah, it's true. We're on social media. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram. And yeah, our readership has increased a lot. We just surpassed the 60,000 visits a month mark. So that was like a huge deal for us because this is seriously like a passion project. Two people working day and night of their own accord to make this happen. Yeah.
We at Project Censored, we know all about passion projects. Yeah. So, but it's the same kind of thing, right? You know, we're a nonprofit, so we're not in the same position as the corporate media or the major publishers, right? And no. I really encourage our listeners to please go to poetsreadingthenews.com. It's a great looking website, by the way, and
it's very interactive.
It's very friendly to navigate. So might you read some things for us?
I'd be more than happy to read some things for you.
I actually just stumbled into a really good one on here, disinformation that looks pretty...
That was just published this morning, actually. I can read that if you want.
Actually, it's right up our alley.
I think.
Yvonne Daly, yes?
Yvonne Daly. So Yvonne Daly she's a self-described aging hippie and a career journalist returning to poetry for sanity in difficult times. And just quickly, you know, it's been remarkable the kinds of people that submit. So many journalists are beginning to write poetry right now.
And I see she's in Vermont with our good friends Rob Williams in Burlington, the University of Vermont. We have so many friends that we work with in Vermont.
So this is Disinformation by Yvonne Daly. Filters in you learn how you were targeted, characterized, misled, misinformed. Turns out that is the goal. Bannon and the false witness at home. The sly ones working for Putin halfway across the planet. In Silicon Valley, too. Who's Game of Thrones and pickup sticks? Are you a throwaway player in fast gains for a dismal heritage? That's what happens when they pick the least qualified to lead and he does the same. Whose hand is actually on the wheel? So now, as a year of comeuppance nears its end, least likely characters come forward, show they aren't flakes or failures. Even a president who served from the end of a leash surprises. Don't you believe it? The country's course downgraded, provoked, Mercury in retrograde. If politics can make you crazy, imagine what life is like for the widow of a soldier killed for what she'll never know. A soldier left behind, while those who railed the loudest vote in lockstep against your best interest. And Puerto Ricans know exactly what we are getting into.
That's powerful imagery coming along with that, and so timely.
It is. This is one of the pieces that Jenna and I call a state of affairs poem because it touches on so many contemporary landmarks. It's a wonderful sort of snapshot of where we are right now.
It is. I mean, and you know, from the Caribbean to Africa, global in its perspective, its reach, and in particular the widow of the soldier and the attention
Absolutely.
On the abuse levied there, and no real discussion or questioning in the corporate media about what the U.S. is doing there.
In Africa. That's the one thing apparently they don't want to talk about.
Well, AFRICOM, we've written about that for years at Project Censored because it is a censored story. And instead of focusing on that issue, we have
a PR crisis from White House.
We do. I think that's why maybe more journalists are turning to poetry, maintaining sanity.
Poetry is a really interesting way to discuss things we don't know. It just kind of presents outwardly questions that are not answered. We don't know. Most Americans don't know that we're even in Africa, that we have a military presence there, why it exists, what our interests are, and why people are dying wearing an American uniform. And so poetry is kind of this beautiful technique of asking these unanswered questions and posing them and giving the space to really meditate on those.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show. I am Mickey Huff. And in this segment of the program, we're looking at and listening to poets reading the news. You can learn more at poetsreadingthenews.com. And so, El Aviv, tell us a little bit more about where you see Poets Reading the News going in its second year.
One of our huge dreams is to transition from being chiefly a digital platform into publishing books. So to that end, we are currently in a fundraising drive to get enough money to start designing and publishing the works in print, which is something our readers have been asking us for.
Especially for writers, there's just something about the pen. There's something about the quill, the paper.
Yeah, there's something about the textile quality of paper. But another thing is creating a lasting archive. There's a lot of discussion right now about when things get published on the internet, where will they end up? And so with that in mind, of course, we fully embrace the internet, but also a huge interest in adding to the cultural record about this moment in history and what people felt and the questions that were raised.
Poets Reading the News is merging the two worlds.
It's merging the two worlds. We're also actually in the process of recording our first podcast. We're hoping to unveil that in the next 2 weeks. So we're really just interested in showing poets doing this on as many platforms as we can, because it carries so well. Of course, poetry, some people argue it's meant to be read aloud. It's not supposed to exist solely on the page. So we definitely agree with that.
Yeah, we'd certainly like to talk more with Poets Reading the News and perhaps having even a regular segment of you reading the news, doing some poetry, and you're getting some submissions from all over.
We are. We get submissions from Nigeria. We get them from Germany, Australia, and India. It's literally a global platform. We're getting topics that aren't getting properly paid attention to in all kinds of places coming to us. We have writers who wouldn't be writing their work if they didn't know they could send it to us. That's something that's probably the most beautiful thing I read from submissions.
Yeah, and that's, you know, Rachel Jolly was on the program earlier from Index on Censorship and Mapping Censorship, and we were talking about the significance of radio and podcasting and technology to get those kind of stories, citizen journalist stories that are either being censored by governments around the world or don't have that kind of platform. And here you are providing this other platform, right? And there's an outpouring of people that are telling you stories that aren't told other places.
It's absolutely true. And that's one of the reasons we call our writers staff poets, as if they were staff journalists. We fully regard them as journalists. In fact, we even copy edit the work and fact check it, just as I would any news article. And it's true that we receive a lot of information and pure data in these works that is truly not being seen elsewhere. So there's a full journalistic aspect to this enterprise, as well as being a poetic literary arts one.
And you designed the site to look like a newspaper.
Yeah, we have sections. It's the exact same. We have, you know, breaking. We have U.S. We have world. We have, you know, an obituary section. It's literally the same.
So, Elle, is there one more poem you could share with our listeners?
Sure. I'd actually like to read something about the wildfires. This is a poem by Maryam Kia Keating, who is a clinical psychologist and writer with a PhD from Boston University. She is a professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, where she has examined the psychological impact of wildfires and other disasters on children and parents in terms of both the consequences of trauma and the potential for resilience. So Maryam Kia Keating is actually a psychologist who specializes in wildfire trauma. And this piece is called Rising, Falling. I am tired of seeing the mountain burning, but the ashes keep coming. They are swirling in the air, collecting on the windshield. I watch them and try to imagine what they meant by the phoenix rising, because these ashes are not valiant or brave. They belong to nothingness and nobody, shedding across my shoulders and sleeves, and then floating off again, indifferent to where they land or travel. News anchors report sundowner winds, contained, evacuation. Someone reassures cleansing, renewal. But nothing is certain, as in everything is uncertain. The fire is relentless. It glows at sunset, rages across the ridges of the mountain, like a life steadfast and unrelenting, fleeting. Breaking news reports, California wildfires. Mirzakhani, Damon, Bennington, no relief in sight. The ashes fall faster like snow. The fire is looming. I look for cues, but no one else is looking up. No one seems to care about the ashes, the death, and the dying. I join in. We pretend not to see the little fragments of trees and brush falling from the sky. We go on with our days, turning our faces from the red sun, blinking away the ashes from our eyes.
That hits very close to home here in Northern California. And Project Censored was founded at Sonoma State University, which was closed for 9 days. Historic closure. And Santa Rosa Junior College hit very hard. Over 500 professors, students lost homes.
Wow.
I'm in Petaluma. Peter Phillips is out in Bodega. Gosh. I mean, we live there. We know people that sadly lost things.
Me too.
And
yeah.
So many of us do in the North Bay, and it's the worst fire in recorded California history in terms of the damage,
That's right.
the scope. By the way, radio was one of the best ways to find out information about what was going on in the fires, and KSRO in particular there, and of course KPFA and Flashpoints did some wonderful programming far and above what we saw on television, which was very sensationalistic and imagery-driven and was not very helpful. And the latest issue of the Bohemian, a Northern California publication, highlights the importance that radio played in emergency response. And now that the very specific emergency has subsided and we see more and more of the devastation, I think we need more poetry and more ways to try to process
exactly.
so many of the things that happened and
exactly.
the things that are not being published or openly discussed.
That's right. It's a traumatic event. You know, even people who weren't living in the North Bay experienced it. I live in Oakland, and I opened my front door and couldn't see across the street. Ashes were falling on me because the smoke was so thick. And poetry has been so consequential in handling that phenomenon, which is, it's almost beyond language. It's you know, it's this incredible natural disaster. The scope is kind of, you know, beyond something we can describe. I have friends whose houses are now just foundations.
Which is why we need metaphor and we need journalism. And in poets reading the news, we're seeing emerging, and we're seeing this coming together.
They are.
So, El Aviv, thank you so much for coming on the Project Censored show today. And again, listeners can go to poetsreadingthenews.com and learn more. And hopefully in upcoming programs, maybe we'll be able to have a segment featuring some of this work.
Thank you so much.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own my special interest groups that fund their campaign.
And that wraps up another episode of the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff, your host and executive producer, along with Peter Phillips. Our producer is Anthony Fest. Erica Bridgman is our engineer. Our senior correspondent is Michael Levitin. The Project Censored Show airs on roughly 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. To learn more, go to projectcensored.org. An archive of all of our shows is online there. And you can also follow and like us on Facebook or Twitter and social media. If you'd like to contact us, please do so through projectcensored.org. We'll see you next time.
Political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, far for little poison. The weapons manufactured, paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. And the times for the master thief, combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.